Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
Hi, everyone. It's the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. With us this week is our expert, Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, otherwise known as NYPIRG. He's back. We love having him here. He knows so much. Welcome, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
So let's talk first about an area you are really a specialist in, not that you're not in so many others, but let's talk about higher education. And there are some real issues with how to get the schools open and not endanger yourself with the coronavirus. You want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the big issue is college students, when they go to campus, they want to hang out with their friends. And you've seen all across upstate New York, off-campus parties, and even occasionally on-campus parties, leading to infection among college students. It's been notable in Syracuse and Cornell. Oneonta, there have been outbreaks that have troubled and, you know, not surprisingly, troubled the administrations. And there's really sort of a split in New York between downstate, where by and large the college experience is being done remotely, and upstate, where they're trying to have in-person classes. And not surprisingly, when you have in-person classes, you have young people meeting with each other, and, you know, they all tend to view themselves as invulnerable. They think that they can, you know, whoop it up and not suffer the consequences. And yet we've seen problems all across the state. So that's the challenge. How do you deal with that? How do you, you know, keep everybody safe as much as possible? And we'll see how it plays out.
So if you're a college president, what are you thinking about? You got a community that depends on the college for its money. Let's face it. People go in, they shop, they do this, that. On the other hand, people don't want to get the virus. So there's a sort of a disconnect, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. Not only that, but many of the upstate schools, the way that they really pay off the loans that they use to build dorms and other facilities is if people are in the dorms. You know, if you don't do that in person, you don't have people in dorms. So I mean, if college presidents are really, they're sort of in the fog of war phase of dealing with this issue. They're trying to make decisions. They don't really know how it's all going to play out. I think, you know, by and large, the broad strokes are they're trying to make the colleges as much as possible sort of a cocoon from coronavirus, similar to what the NBA is doing down in Orlando. And yet, you know, people can come and go, so you're going to have these issues. So they have to have frequent testing, isolation, and responses to outbreaks that occur on the college campuses in much the same way as governors have to deal with it in their states.
To say nothing of, you know, one of the things that motivates an awful lot of young people and older people, too, and that's the sex drive. I mean, obviously, if you say to people, no communal fooling around here, it's unlikely that some people will be able to get past that.
Well, and particularly young people view themselves as invulnerable. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the military is made up of young people. It's because young people sort of don't think about or don't really have enough experience to think through the consequences of long-term actions, of the impact on long-term on their lives. And so in this particular case, they hear a lot about how young people are really not as susceptible as older people, and that's true. But when you get sick from this, it's devastating, and it doesn't necessarily mean you die, but you could suffer long-term consequences. So people don't think it through. Young people want to whoop it up, some of them anyway, on college campuses. I'm sure, just like everyone else, the vast majority of young people, even on college campuses, behave themselves. But when you have an outbreak in a dorm, for example, getting infected doesn't necessarily mean you were at a party. It just may mean that you were exposed to someone in the dorm or in the classroom that was at the party. And that's the problem with the pandemic, is it's not necessarily an individual's behavior. It's the individual's behavior collectively that impacts on everyone.
So, Blair Horner, what do you do if you're the governor? And, you know, let's face it, the governor has a great deal to do with the way people are behaving and what the rules are. And he goes ahead and appoints one of his closest aides. Well, appoints is a little strong, but he gets him appointed, obviously, to be the chancellor of the state university.
I mean, it's unprecedented that someone is appointed to be the chancellor of the university with the kinds of experience that Jim Malakas has. Now, that being said, I mean, you know, he's obviously had experiences running vast institutions like state government as the director of state operations. He's a smart guy. And so, you know, what the SUNY trustees were thinking when they made that decision, of course, is not entirely clear because, you know, we don't really know. We weren't part of the process. But they didn't do a national search, and they pretty much set this up so that the governor's, one of the governor's top aides became the chancellor. Now, he was the head of the Empire State College. He has a PhD, and he has a lot of experience in running big organizations. So we'll see if their unprecedented action pays off for the university, because you want the state university to succeed. So we certainly hope that everything works out fine, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I'd rather have Malakas than a professor of classical Greek with some of the same old credentials, because after all, you're going to need the governor in all of this, and you'd rather have somebody who has his ear than somebody who doesn't. Do you think unkind about the classical Greek?
No. I mean, most of the previous 13 heads of the SUNY system were not just professors that were picked to be the head of the institutions. They're typically provosts or in other. They have some academic experience, but they also have higher educational and administrative experience, because SUNY system is a vast sort of operation, one of the biggest in the country. And so, you know, you need a lot of organizational skills to pull it off. So certainly having somebody who is a close aide to the governor could well rebound to the benefit of the state university. I'm sure that's what some of the trustees at least were thinking. But again, he has experience as the director of state operations with dealing with a vast enterprise, one of the biggest in the country, known as New York State government. And that's really the skills that someone needs to run a gigantic operation, as well as being sensitive to the academics, sort of broadly defined, of the university itself.
As well as being a friend of the governor.
Well, I mean, we'll see how it all plays out. I mean, you know, ultimately the proof will be in the pudding, and he's a young guy, so if he succeeds, he could be there for a long time. And again, everyone hopes he does.
Well, while we're on the subject, Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group, let's go one step further in terms of understanding what's at stake at the state university. The governor has announced something like you and I have talked about this before, $16 billion shortfall. Then there's the matter of the MTA, which has a like amount of money. The governor has been saying to the feds, you got to give us the money, and we don't know whether they will or not, whether Nancy Pelosi and her group will have their way in the Democratic House. So if he doesn't get it, what are going to be the consequences for the state university?
Well, historically, I mean, if you look at the 20 to 30 year trend at the state university, it's been a dramatic shift in paying for the state university from state government to the students and their families. I mean, that's exactly what you see over the 30 years. Now, the unique financial circumstances the state's in now, really financial situation that you haven't seen since the Great Depression, it is likely that trend will accelerate. So one aspect of this will be continued increases in tuition. There'll be a pullback, I assume, in support for the state universities, some of their capital needs. Ultimately, it's going to turn on what the governor and the legislature decide to do to balance the budget. And you can't balance a gigantic budget hole, you know, through higher education. So the bigger context is what happens. Does the state generate substantially more revenues, which they're going to have to do, to fill in these budget deficits? And when they do that, what's the impact on higher education, right? So it's not, the tail doesn't wag the dog. In this case, the dog is the bigger deficit, and how the state attempts to deal with that, it's going to be some cuts in services, and it's going to have to be increases in revenues And what that ratio looks like, I think, will determine what happens ultimately to the state universities, the city university, and the independent colleges and universities that all rely on state support.
You know, you bring up an interesting subject, Blair Horner. In the old days, there was a fierce competition between the state university and public universities, including city university and the private or independent colleges. Am I wrong that this has sort of dissipated a bit?
Well, the tension that existed between the public and the independent sectors was driven largely by resources, and the independent sector now gets a lot less than it used to. And so I guess that if you look at it purely in a dollars and cents way, the independent sector doesn't get as much support. Therefore, the tension isn't as great. The independent sector is hurting, though. I mean, you look at some of these smaller liberal arts colleges that do not have the big endowments. They're really hurting, and the pandemic is going to certainly hurt them more. And to what extent, of course, I don't know. But it is definitely some of these communities that, you know, you mentioned earlier in our conversation, that a lot of these upstate communities really rely on the local college to be their main industry that employ lots of people. And that's true in the public sector, but it's also true in the independent sector. And what, you know, how that ultimately all plays out is anyone's guess. But if the state keeps diminishing support for the independent sector and you have a pandemic, that could lead to some of these schools having to close their shop.
Well, Blair Horner, do you see a time, because I do, I'll be honest with you, that education in New York State will be largely public and very little private? I mean, we'll always have the NYUs and some of the other places. But, you know, the list that came out from that NYU professor of colleges that were in danger, including places like Bard and Skidmore, very frightening because they're excellent places.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's going to be determined by state policy, largely, as to what happens to these schools. I mean, the state does provide aid, direct aid, to the independent sector, but it's often on the budgetary chopping block, and it probably is inadequate. So I think if the state starves the independent sector, it's going to devastate a lot of the smaller independent colleges that do not have large endowments. You're absolutely right. Now, again, state policy is what will determine that, and if the state wants to have maintain a robust independent sector, it will have to provide the support to make that happen. For the colleges, it's not just for the colleges. I mean, as the college students, the tuition assistance program applies to students that go to the independent colleges too, but it's also direct aid to the institutions. And so you really have to do both, and hopefully they will.
In the old days, it was the Republicans that always protected the private sector, right? Am I right about that?
There was a lot more support for the independent sector among the Senate Republicans and for SUNY, frankly, because so many of the upstate areas are covered by the state university. And the tension was really the upstate Republican leadership of the Senate versus the downstate Democratic control of leadership of the Assembly, which tended to look out for the city university system. Now, of course, that's a little probable. That's certainly too stark. I mean, I've dealt a lot with higher education over many years, and I know that both houses cared about all of them. But if you were forced to pick priorities, often that was the game that got played.
So have you seen any change, Blair Horner, in the way in which higher education is treated by the state Senate since the Democrats took over?
Well, I mean, not yet. The trajectory is the trajectory, and the Democrats have only had control of the Senate for 2 years, and, you know, up until the coronavirus hit, you know, it was sort of the salad days in terms of the budget. I mean, there was always these budget shortfalls and tension and everything else, but I haven't seen, clearly the Senate Democratic leadership is based downstate, and so they care about downstate, but there's a lot of independent colleges and universities in the downstate area as well as upstate. So I had not detected a financial stretch. It was really between the executive and the legislature about how you funded higher education, where the governor would advance proposals to cut programs that the legislature then would fill back in as part of the budget dance that they would go through every year. So I haven't seen it broken down by sector. It's been more the traditional tension between the executive and legislative branches over what gets funded and what does not.
Here's a more obscure question, which is, we don't have proper internet. Now, we're saying to some schools are saying, we can't let you back in, we'll do it over the internet, but we don't have an internet system that will work. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the digital divide is real. and it's exacerbated by the pandemic. It's real in terms of income, where poor people in urban areas in particular have a harder time getting access to the internet. And if they have it, getting access to it by having computers that can adequately handle the various social, the various platforms that are used to deliver content, like the Zooms, for example. You got to have computers that can handle that. So there's that. And then you get into places in upstate New York and rural areas where they may not have access physically to the internet at all. But you can drive around places in the North Country and you can't even get cell reception for your phone. So there's a real problem. It's unusual in Western societies because if you go to Europe, this doesn't happen. You know, it's really going to be, again, it's a function of governmental policy to make sure that in a world where people are going to work increasingly from remote locations and get educated from remote locations, they have to have the infrastructure for that to happen, both on the internet side and on the home technology side.
You and I, Blair Horner, have discussed many times the fact that this isn't looking good for a governor who's going to have to come up with the money to fund the government. And a lot of people have been looking at different ways of adjusting how much money the state has. There are some leaders in the state legislature, for example, who want to have higher taxes on the multimillionaire, which sometimes means starts with the multimillionaires and then it comes down the line to just people with a couple of million in the bank. And then there's something called this stock transfer tax, which I believe you've always been for. You put a couple of pennies on every stock transfer and you resolve your problem, assuming that the stock market doesn't move to New Jersey. So what do you make of all of that?
Well, I mean, so there's the specific and then there's sort of the general, right? So just to take a look at it from the general perspective from 30,000, the nation is facing now the highest levels of a deficit since World War II. And right. What happened after World War II was a dramatic increase in the tax rates for everyone, up to 90% tax rates for the wealthiest people because you had to pay it off. So I think as a practical national policy, you're going to have to change the tax structure to raise a hell of a lot more money. In New York, I think a similar discussion occurs. You can't run deficits at the state level, and so you have to have a balanced budget, and the state has to come up with revenues. And it's facing unprecedented deficits since, as I mentioned before, since the Great Depression. So you're going to have to come up with revenues. One of the ways, and it'll probably be a bunch of different ways they'll do it, one of the ways is to raise the rates on the wealthy, and despite the governor's arguments that they'll run away to another state, all states are in the same boat, so probably a lot of the states are going to do the same thing. So there's that. Another is the stock transfer tax, which has been on the books in New York since 1905. The state can, and until 1981, the state collected the money. Now, that's a long time. Then starting in the early 80s, they decided not to collect it, and they kept it on the books. They collect the money, but they give it right back to Wall Street. That would generate billions of dollars. And the way it's set up is 0.25 cent tax rate on the selling and purchasing of stocks. And so for people like Blair Horner, who have virtually nothing on the stock market, I would pay nothing, basically nothing. And for someone like Alan Chartok, multimillionaire, then you may not have to pay any either, unless you're in the daily buying and selling of stocks. Speculators, it's a speculator tax. The more you do it, the more tax you pay. So that's the state would generate as little as $6 billion, as much as $16 billion, depending on the activity on Wall Street. If Wall Street wants to move its activities, and they talk about New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy said last week that he's thinking about doing the same thing because the states are all in the same boat. And if you look around the world, Hong Kong, London, they have these taxes already. And my guess is, depending on what administration gets in, they're going to look at this nationally because the nation needs the money too.
We're talking to Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPER. Blair Horner, a progressive party, says New York is making it harder to stay on the ballot. Now, let me put it this way. There were two Andrews, Cuomo. The first was the mean Andrew. People said he's too mean, you know, he's too manipulative. And then the new Andrew, the one we all saw and loved as he read out the news during the pandemic and what New York State was doing. But there's one holdover, I think, to the old Andrew. Maybe you see it differently. Sometimes we do disagree. And that, Blair Horner, involved the Working Families Party, who put up a candidate against him the last time he ran for governor. And I think to clean it up, he was piqued as a result of that. And so the rules got changed with the help of the legislature to make it more difficult for the Working Families Party to survive. Want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, the basic facts are all true. The governor was certainly, was supportive of the idea of making it harder for all minor parties to get on the ballot.
Yeah, but we knew who he was after, didn't we?
Yeah, no, but the impact is everybody, right? So it's not just the Conservative Party, the Independence Party, the Working Families Party, the Serve America Movement Party, the Green Party. They all have the same problem now. And it is true that it's now going to be a lot harder for these minor parties to get automatic ballot status in New York, because they're going to have to hit thresholds of votes that are going to be very difficult for them to do. And, you know, is it because of personal pique? I mean, I'm not a psychoanalyst. I have no idea what goes on in people's heads, and nobody has said that other than people observing
it
from the outside.
I said it.
People from the outside. I don't know what the governor was thinking. But it was clear in both the commission that was created to create public financing that was their big issue, pushed by Democratic Party leader Jay Jacobs. It was clear that was something.
Jay Jacobs is on a string from the governor. Let's not act as
the governor controls the Democratic Party. But whether or not Jay Jacobs was acting on behalf of the governor or himself, who knows, right? I mean, we can all guess, but they pushed it. And the commission was created to create a system of public financing. And yet that commission pushed the same proposal to make it harder for minor parties to get on the ballots. Why? It had nothing to do. I was at every one of the hearings. I was very active in this whole that whole effort. There was no justification for it at all. One Uber driver showed up and said he supported it, and we found out later he was an activist in Democratic politics. So there was literally nothing. They just made it up, and it came out of nowhere. And then the court struck it down, and that's why it got stuck in the budget. So the governor and the legislative leaders have decided to make it harder for New York State to have minor parties. That's the upshot.
It's self-serving, though, right? I mean, come on. Yes or no?
Well, it certainly means that they don't have to listen to minor parties as much. I mean, you still have to be voting in New York, right? So you can still run on minor party lines, and whatever you get counts toward your total. So I don't think it's a clear that the legislature in particular or the governor wants to get rid of minor parties, but they've made it a lot harder for them to be on the ballot.
So I have a question for you. Do you believe in the tooth fairy? Come on. You're so goody two shoes.
Well,
you know, I don't know
more than I do, Alan. Ask him.
I'll ask him. I've asked him before. I'll ask him again. But you'd really have to be quite naive not to believe that he's the guy who's pushing all of this. That's what I think.
Well, I mean, it's clear that the Commission on Public Financing was pushing, and it was clear that it was not in their mandate, and it was clear they didn't have to do it.
But who pushed them?
They pushed it.
Yeah,
well,
Jacobs, come on.
You can connect the dots. My job is to just focus on dots.
Yeah, well, I'm connecting the dots. And, you know, I like the governor. I think he's done a good job. But the fact of the matter is, there are times I really do wonder. Now, I have to have a personal disclaimer here. I used to be a big fan of the Working Families Party. Not so much anymore. It's a long story. But anyway, you know, that doesn't mean that you change the system because you're angry at one party for having grief.
That's right. I mean, you should never use, and we see it too often, you should never use government policy as a way to punish your political enemies. Public policy is supposed to be benefiting the public, not your own personal power. So whoever does that is doing the wrong thing.
Hey, Blair Horner, do we have any update on the critical census in New York State and whether it's going well? Because if it doesn't go well, New York is going to lose at least one congressman, probably two, or could be two. And if people don't answer the door, and is New York more at risk than other places? And if so, in your blue book, why?
Well, I mean, New York always struggles with this, particularly in the New York City area, but also in rural areas in upstate. But the where New York is a laggard compared to many other states in the country. But it's not, that's not new necessarily. Cutting it off early, which is what the Trump administration has now done, early meaning by the end of September, the enumerators were supposed to be out until the end of October, is definitely going to hurt the census count. It's going to hurt all across the country, of course, but it's going to hurt New York. And so I think the census count is going to undercount. It's not going to be adequate, and it's going to cost political power in New, cost New York political power. There's no two ways about it. How devastating, we don't know, and where in the state it impacts, we don't know yet, but it's likely to be parts of New York City. And, you know, why is because, well, the Trump administration is hostile to many of the groups that would normally count. I mean, the census is supposed to count every single person in the country, whether or not they're a citizen. And the way that the Trump administration has been operating the census is to make it as hard as possible to count people who are not traditional citizens of the country. And that's playing out, and that's going to hurt New York.
Blair Horner, one last question. You can only have a minute on this, and that is ethics reform. Do you ever think we're going to see any kind of meaningful ethics reform in the New York State legislature now?
Well, you know, there are bills that have been introduced. There are supporters in the legislative branch who want to make it happen. Historically, new governors come in, and they package themselves as the reformer. Once they become governor for a long time, they become the status quo. They're less interested in reform. Whether or not there's ethics reform in New York hinges on what Governor Cuomo wants to see happen, because he's the big guy in terms of the process. And so, you know, we're going to keep banging our heads against that the brick wall on that. But it's been very hard, and the prognosis, unless there's another gigantic scandal, is probably slim.
Thank you, regular guest Blair Horner. We so appreciate your wisdom, your ability to come in and do combat and to tell us what you think. It really means a great deal to us, and we do thank you for it.
Always great talking to you, Alan.
Always welcome here. Thanks again.